Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Jen Tullock. Good day.
Good day. In studio today, we have Dan Weber and Beau Rapier of Flatiron Wines and Spirits. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Hey, great to be here.
How you doing?
It's good to see you.
Beau, for the purposes of today's show, would you prefer Rapier or Rapier?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking to you earlier. I do not.
It's already a tough question because I get asked it all the time. I think here people usually say Rapier. In New York.
That's what I always
it's
New York.
It's sexy regardless.
Yeah.
It's a win-win.
I want to put like a reel together of my mispronunciation of words, like pronunciation.
I would buy that on iTunes for 35 cents.
Because, you know, last week I was like, Frank Winter. Winters.
That's fine.
That's a
forgivable mistake. Speaking of people I could hear talk all day long. Hopefully we're going to have a quick phone call with my beloved mother later on in the show, Mary Gay Tullock, Southern Belle extraordinaire and Thanksgiving cook expert. Have a quick chat about Thanksgiving traditions in the South and what everyone's eating this season. What are you doing this year?
You know, I actually have no idea, and I'm okay with that. Aaron doesn't eat turkey, so I think maybe we'll just go have, I don't know, French food.
Well-seasoned seitan.
No. No, not going to do that. But Thanksgiving tradition that we usually always try to make happen is going to the Russian and Turkish baths.
That is a great tradition.
Because it's not as crowded. And who thinks of going there on Thanksgiving?
The last time I was at the baths, I was on the rooftop smoking a cigarette and a very large Israeli man offered me a jar of Israeli pickles. And in that moment, I thought, yes, I am a New Yorker.
Did you take a pickle?
Of course I took a pickle. I took like three pickles. They were delicious.
Amazing. Speaking of delicious.
Speaking of delicious.
There was the review heard around the world.
We've got to talk about it. Everybody's got talking about it. So Pete Wells, New York Times, infamous food critic, writes this review of Guy Fieri's new restaurant.
American Bar and Kitchen,
American Bar and Kitchen, which is an ambitious name for a restaurant. And it's scathing. It's kind of awful, but it's also incredibly hilarious. And if you haven't read it or heard about it, then you've been lucky and living under a rock. But it flew because it is so scathing and it's also very witty. So of course everybody jumped on and was like, "Yeah, Guy Fieri, fuck that guy." But then there have been all these conversations, you know, among industry friends this week. We were just talking to somebody in studio this morning about like, well, is that actually okay? Like, yes, it's very smart. Is it funny? Is this permissible? Is this crossing a line? What does that mean? But here in studio with us today to shed some light on the matter is an old friend of ours, the Dame Joan Plowright, the Baroness Olivier, to offer some selections from said review. The Baroness.
Welcome, Baroness.
Joe, do we have any of that classical music? Doesn't matter.
I will get some.
I know you.
She
will.
Can go without it.
I don't. I mean. The Baroness. Well, she's signaling to me in the corner that she's doing some silent vocal warm ups. I don't know how that's possible, but she is. She just seems to be shaking violently and spitting on the floor.
It's quite a sight.
But she should be ready in just a moment. I, for one, am excited to revisit the review. I also, Jesse and I, were going to go have lunch.
We still will.
We still are going to.
How can we talk about it without actually experiencing it?
It seems hypocritical.
It really doesn't. A lot of people were saying, like, how can you go? If it's this terrible, why would you put money into it? And I'm like, I love a train wreck. And
I love a blue margarita.
And I will go to Red Lobster.
Oh, here we are. Baroness, are you ready? She says yes.
Did panic grip your soul
as you stared into the whirling hypno wheel of the menu, where adjectives and nouns spin in a crazy vortex. When you saw the burger described as Guy's, Pat, Lafrida, Custom Blend, All Natural Creekstone Farm, Black Angus Beef, Patty, LTOP, Lettuce, Tomato, Onion and Pickle, SMC, Super Melty Cheese, and a slathering of donkey sauce on garlic buttered brioche, did your mind touch the void for a minute? Did you notice that the menu was an unreliable predictor of what actually came to the table? Were the bourbon butter crunch chips missing from your Almond Joy cocktail, too? Was your deep-fried boulder of ice cream the size of a standard scoop?
Just a small selection. Thank you, Baroness. Thank you so much. Oh, and with that, she's gone. She's out. She never sticks around for long.
My favorite moment is when he, you know, is talking about how the banh mi is like pulled pork, coleslaw, and pickles. And he's
it's an
like,
Arby's sandwich.
He's like, in no way does this resemble a banh mi. Just like, in no way do you resemble Emily Dickinson.
He says something about, like, he's like, is this whole charade just a brilliant conceptual art piece that none of us are intelligent enough to understand? Oh, man.
It may be, and we'll have to find out next week or in the next week.
But. We're going to go. We'll get some sound. I really would like to interview people, do some exit interviews.
I'm sure they will not.
I had.
You mean like guests?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I know we can't interview the staff. They'll taser us with a like neon blue taser.
But you could post up outside. And
exactly. Yeah. That's my thinking. Get some hot cider and a thermos. Get a camping blanket. Get a little lantern. It could be magic, Jesse. It could be magic.
It's like magic.
Have you guys read some of the like reactions to it? They're like to that art that are negative.
Yeah, they're very polarized. I mean, as they should be, because they're either like, "Yeah, Pete Wells, Messiah," or they're like, "This is really shitty of you. Grow up."
It's really interesting, but really good friend of mine actually wrote one for Gawker, Corey Jefferson, and he like, but and now knowing that we're talking about this now, I wish I'd actually sat down and read it like I was supposed to be.
But you will after I didn't, this,
but,
I'm sure.
But that said, since I know him so well, I have an idea of what he was saying, because we've had this conversation before about the sort of, you know, food snobbery, food criticism, and that sort of thing. And from my standpoint, though, like, it's totally fair game when you're taking on somebody like that. It's clearly, like, that operation is a cynical operation to make money, right? Like, that's the idea. They're not, Pete Wells didn't, like, go to some, like, you know, poorly executed diner somewhere and like be like, oh man, this, you know, and,
this is terrible. And
rip, you know, yeah,
someone didn't who considers himself a celebrity chef. I mean, that's
yeah,
me, yeah,
yeah. I think it's like totally
you
fair
put
game.
Yourself in the lion's den.
Yeah, and in the end, that restaurant's still going to make a bunch of money, and so it's not going to make that big of a
maybe more. You know, in the end, it perhaps will work in his favor. But here's the other thing:
Are any of the
New York Times readership actually going to be going to this restaurant anyway? That's my question. Like, is anyone who actually subscribes to the New York Times and takes their time to read a food review by Pete Wells, were they already planning on going to Guy Fieri's?
No,
probably not.
And they were ready to read a takedown piece. That's what they wanted to see. Like, yes, here comes another beatdown of Guy Fieri in the Wednesday section.
Yeah, if anything, that piece might have got a few people that read the Times that never would have even heard of it. To go there, just
well,
to be
we're
like,
gonna go.
See, yeah, you guys are gonna go. You wouldn't have gone before, right?
No, I actually think that a terrible review and an amazing review probably have similar reactions, similar stampedes to
outcomes.
The restaurants. Yeah, exactly. So we're gonna take a break. Come back. We'll talk to you guys about Flatiron Wines and Spirits.
The morning after.
Everyone is a website by Huntronic on the heritageradionetwork.org.
following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
The morning after, we are back, ladies and gents. In studio with us today, two very handsome gentlemen from Flatiron Wines and Spirits, Dan Weber and Beau Hoppier. Lovely to have you, gentlemen. How's it going?
It's going well. It's great to be here. Like this is a lot of fun. This is great. Looking out on everybody eating their brunch at Roberta's is pretty awesome.
Pizza looks pretty good.
Now, Beau and Jesse, you guys know each other from Arizona, right?
We both lived in Tempe at the same time, and yes. You went to Arizona State, right?
Yeah. I went to ASU. Yeah, I was there doing. We were on the scene on Mill Avenue for just simultaneously. Yeah.
Where do you buy your wine in Arizona?
If I go back to Arizona. I try to take stuff with me, to be honest.
Yeah, it's really mm-hmm. difficult. You can go to Whole Foods, but yeah,
there are a couple stores that are okay though. And Tucson actually is a little bit better than Phoenix, strangely enough.
That's got to be like a marginal truth though, because
it's not a lot, the problem in Arizona is that there's a limited number of distributors. I mean, mm-hmm. there's not people yeah. bringing in a lot of interesting wines, and there's still a kind of 5-10 year ago focus on big, rich West Coast style international wines that's fading. And I think that there's the food scene is getting better. Well, last time I went, to a farm to table restaurant in Tucson that was clearly whoever did that had been to Brooklyn several times, and like their menus were handwritten on chalkboards. You know, I mean, they were like totally.
They had the
mixologist.
And, sure, you know, they were playing vinyls.
Exactly. So I think that's changing. Along with that, hopefully, you know, the wine options will.
What if that is the future of commercial dining in the Midwest? Like, what if that is the trickle down effect? It's going to be all like handlebar mustached
subway tiles
and
you can get an egg on absolutely anything.
Yeah,
yep. Absolutely. Egg or beet on anything. Well, speaking of distributors, I was reading a bit about you guys, and I you're a Manhattan based wine retailer, but you source exclusively from New York. Yes.
As far as distribution is concerned.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you have to. The way that it works, it's a very complex system of importing and distributing wine in the United States, and then it's also breaks down state by state. But in New York, like most places, it's a three-tier system. So you have importers that have a license to import wine, whether that's from France or Chile or California, you're still importing wine because mm-hmm. it's to New York. The only exception would be wine made in New York, which has its own sort of area. But they import wine, and then you have distributors who are the ones that warehouse the wine and distribute it, literally truck it out. And sometimes your companies are an importer and distributor, mm-hmm. and other times there's a lot of very small importing companies, and there's a few large kind of umbrella distributors. But there's, you know, New York is a huge market. It's one of the best wine markets in the world. There are hundreds and hundreds of different importers companies in New York.
So you guys started at UVA. Is that where you met?
Yeah, I started at UVA about 8 some odd years ago.
UVA in Williamsburg.
UVA in Williamsburg, in its previous location when it was in the mini mall on North Fifth Street.
Oh, I never
knew
that.
This is way back in the day when the Bedford Cheese Shop and both UVA were sort of. If you walk past where the entrance to the Verb is on North Fifth Street into the mini mall, you can find sort of where the wine shop and the cheese shop used to be. Now where UVA was is a lingerie store.
And there's a children's store. And so that's, you know, like it sells toys and skinny jeans for kids. So that's kind of where I can see how Williamsburg has evolved
yeah.
over the past
yeah,
10
yeah.
years.
Yeah. So I was working there. I just liked, it was a cool place to hang out. They listened to good music and they talked about wine. I figured out that if you got a job at the wine store, you could get paid to talk to folks about dinner and get a really good discount at the same time. Uh-huh. And then after about a year or so, Beau showed up. And then eventually we moved the wine shop to UVO to where it is now on the corner of North 6th and Bedford. And we worked together with Justin Cherno and the rest of our squad there, you know,
buying, many years
selling wines for many, many years, talking to folks about what is delicious.
And so have you kind of taken that the same concept of UVA and moved it now to the Flatiron? Because I know we were talking that it is the same people in business.
To a certain extent, though. I think that there was, I mean, a lot of our knowledge and our education came from working at UVA and from what we did there, and that's how we learned wine retail and the business. That said, you know, it's in New York City and all over, you know, wine shops are also neighborhood shops. Mm-hmm. And in New York City, neighborhoods are different from neighborhood to neighborhood, very different.
Absolutely.
And so we realized that, and we also realized that Manhattan kind of, even though Brooklyn is a very hot, hip place right now, it's still Brooklyn, and like there's Manhattan has a clientele that you don't get in Brooklyn. And people, you know, it's Williamsburg, Bedford Avenue is super close to Manhattan, but there's people that are really into wine that would never think of going one stop on the L train to buy wine. So mm-hmm. your clientele, your customer base is much bigger and broader, and there's a lot more things that you can do. And we realize that. So the Flatiron Shop, Flatiron Wines is, you know, we have way more options, much bigger selection. There's, you know, UVA probably has 750 plus wines, and Flatiron has, you know, 1800 or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
But it's a much bigger shop.
I would say that that's probably the crucial thing, though, that we take from UVA to Manhattan is that the intense way that we taste wine to sort of curate the selection, and what I think is ultimately making both shops successful, also another shop sort of in our consortium of wine world called Blanc Rouge, which is in Dumbo, is that we really take it intensely seriously. You know, like we taste every wine that we buy. We put a lot of thought into everything, whether it's like a really casual, everyday $11 bottle of wine or something that is from, you know, really off the beaten path or something that's really collectible. There's nothing really there that's there just by chance. Everything has a real reason to be there. We want folks to be able to sort of know that we filtered through the, like, you know, epic amount of terrible wine out there to select the hard work, really good.
Exactly. We joke about that all the time with customers and people are like, oh, you know, it's a really hard job. You have to taste, you know, 50 wines every day or something like that. And they're like, aha, I wish I had your job. You know, it's nice. Our job is very nice.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I love to taste wines, but there are a lot of not so tasty wines out mm-hmm. there. And, you know, I think the difference between what we do at UVA and at Blanc Rouge and at Flatiron and then all of the other really great wine shops, because there are lots of great wine shops in New York City. I mean, some of the best wine shops in the world are in New York City, no question. But there's a lot of liquor stores and wine shops. And mm-hmm. I think the key difference is that, like, do you taste the wine and do you care? And do you, whether wine costs $10 or $100 or do you kind of sort of go down a list and check things off? Like, I need a Merlot, I need a Sauv Blanc at this price, and oh, I can make a lot of money on this. Check, check, check. Boom, boom, boom. Which is sort of the formula for the vast majority of liquor stores, wine shops in New York and across the country. So that's kind of the key difference.
It's a different business model. It's like a quality based model as opposed to like purely a price based model, I would say.
You know, so what do you,
we never think about price.
So I mean, aside from your hard thought put into the wine selection, what else do you think that Flatiron Wines, you know, what sets you apart from other shops in the neighborhood?
Well, I think that what sets us apart from other shops in our neighborhood is the diversity of selection. You know, like Bo was saying, we have about 1,500 different wines. We have a huge selection of things from all over the great kind of classical wine growing zones of the world. So there's tons of great wines from the Loire Valley, from Burgundy, from the Rhone, from Italy, from Germany, from Austria, from California, from, you know, all from New York State. And it's a nice big open space. We have a great table in the back. We put out tons of tasting events. And we really, you know, we always have things open for folks to taste. And what we're there for, and the sort of what makes it fun to be there, is we love to talk about wine. We'd like to have, you know, folks who come in the wine shop, ask a question, and go from there. You know, so we're constantly in dialogue with our customers, trying to build relationships and build communities so that people, you know, so once a week can learn what they want, we can, you know, sort of serve them better, but also to help educate about wine, mm-hmm. to, you know, help everybody enjoy it more, to have a good time, to, you know, wine is delicious, it's supposed to be fun. Talk about it like that, you know?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Like, how do you help to educate your customers? Because, you know, I just working at Terroir, I know that it is daunting to look at wines that you've never, ever heard of. And I'm sure that, you know, you guys have some super eclectic stuff. Yeah. How do you approach people? You know, how do you share with them, you know, these different wines and make them feel, I don't know. I feel like people think that they're stupid.
Yeah,
or they always approach things like, "Oh, I know nothing about wine."
We had this sort of idea about people and the trepidation of people when they walk into a wine shop or they go to sit down at a restaurant and they look at a wine list. When Eric Asimov had his book come out, which is kind of addressing that recently, and they were actually in filming at our shop to do a little segment, and we, you know, off camera, we were just talking to him and. About that, and it's interesting because there is this, and it's, I think it's going back, you know, decades now, probably in the United States, but this idea that a well-rounded sort of person who knows things should just know about wine, as opposed to, like, you don't think that just because you're, you know, a well-rounded educated person that you need to know a lot about, you know, engineering or medicine. You don't walk into the doctor's office and say, you know, "I'm sorry, doctor, I don't know a whole lot about medicine. Would you mind helping me out anyway?" We get that daily. People come in and say, "I'm really sorry, I don't know a lot about wine."
Yeah.
So you don't, what's to apologize for? Like, your job is to, like, have a good time and drink mm-hmm. wine. It's our job to know a lot about wine. That's what we do. That's our business.
We spend hours and hours studying it so you don't have to.
Exactly. So, I mean, but that's the whole approach, is that, like, you know, that's our job is to know about the wine and then to make everybody feel comfortable picking out wine. And if they want to be educated a tiny bit or a lot or anywhere in between, that's what we do.
Yeah, and I think it's about the way that you approach it also, right? Like, if you, you know, like, if it's great to turn somebody on to wine. It's an awesome feeling, like, when you have the conversation. You listen as carefully as you possibly can. You ask the detective questions, you know, what are you going to have it with? Is there something that you like, you don't like, a wine from a certain part of the world you like, you don't like, whatever. When you have the conversation, you listen with, you know, honest ears, with empathy. When you get them the right bottle and you feel confident about it and you're excited and they're excited and they go home, they taste the wine, it's delicious, and they come back and they're like, "That was amazing, that was the best bottle of wine." Now you've got a relationship with that mm-hmm. customer, that trust, that's invaluable. And that's really, like, you know, that's the whole reputation that you have as somebody who sells wine, is when you tell somebody, "Hey, I'm telling you, this is delicious. I think you're going to like it." Mm-hmm. Are you being real, you know, and you're doing your best to have them get matched with the right bottle. And when they come back and they tell you that it's great, you're happy for them. But also it feels amazing for you because, you know, if you're passionate about wine, if you believe that it's something that's exciting, you know, has meaning beyond just, like, being purely something to drink, which I think, you know, we do, you know, it feels good to, like, get folks to get excited about it. You know, wine is exciting. It, like, really has something going on, you know?
And the more you do that, then the more that they feel comfortable and they come back and they're more and more comfortable. And then pretty soon it's just, you know, "Hey, I'm doing this, having this for dinner, these people over, what should we do? Let's do this." And then they can get, I mean, and then once that sort of, like, that trepidation, that sort of sheen of like, "Oh, I'm nervous about what wine to bring or pick out," once that goes away, then you can do what you're supposed to do with wine, which is sit down and, like, enjoy it and talk and, like, have a good time, which is mm-hmm.
customers see you having this conversation with other people, right? So, like, you know, you'll be standing there and talking to somebody who comes into the wine shop all the time, you know, you'll be chatting about wine, maybe you have something open and you pour them a taste, whatever, and somebody else comes in, it's their first time in the wine shop. You know, it's really important also to, like, turn to that person and be like, "Hey, can I help you? Can I pour you some wine? What's going on? We try to engage them as much as possible, sort of, like, diffuse the fear of going up to somebody and be like, "Excuse me, I have no idea what any of these bottles are. Help," you know?
Yeah.
And, like, I think also that helps to curate their actual consumption experience, because, I mean, I love my parents very much, but they were self-proclaimed, they were in the dark about wine, and I remember going to college and, you know, just wanting to get drunk, right? I'm a young kid, and it was like, well, what can you buy for cheap? Well, I'll buy this bottle of...
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right, I'm sure you do. I'm sure you don't.
You've never been drunk.
You know, I'll buy this bottle of Yellowtail. Well, I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know what the difference between... At that time, I don't know the difference between a Cabernet and a Merlot. I don't know what the grapes are. And I'm just getting it to get high. And so... And I think this is... I mean, specifically an American thing. I'm sure it exists everywhere, but specifically in America, our reverence for wine, not that it has to be a big hoity-toity holy thing, is non-existent because we're intimidated by it. And so I think we sort of bastardize it by making it this just like cheap means to get high so often.
And there's a certain amount of branding thing going on. You know, like some folks are always asking for like name brand wines.
Right.
Maybe we don't have something like that. So it's also about, you know, like trying to figure out how to turn the conversation. But yeah, I think it's really tough, you know.
But it's great when you do, because like my mom, who hopefully we're going to talk to here in a little bit after the break.
I can't wait.
Is she's just become a wine drinker. And, you know, she's a woman in her 50s, and she wasn't raised in a family or a culture that appreciated wine or even consumed it at all. And she's just become a wine drinker, and me and my fiance both work in the industry. And so every time she visits, she's like, I want to learn a new grape every time. I want to taste a new bottle. And she'll come in. And she'll come into either one of our works, and we'll do tastings with her. And it's become a hobby, and she loves it. And it's awesome. So cool because there is such a purity about her experience with wine, because she's not doing it to impress anyone. She just wants to know. And she's realized that instead of buying, not that she would drink all of this, but instead of buying a magnum of, you know, Fetzer, she could buy, you know, spend a little more, or maybe not even, and get a bottle of something that is more finely crafted and really enjoy it and have a discussion about it. And it's
cool, like, because it just shows that delicious is delicious. Like,
yeah.
Your mom maybe didn't have the experiences before, but when she had something that was really good, all of a sudden it's like a light goes off in your brain and you're like, oh, wait a minute, what is that?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And I think that everybody that kind of falls in love with wine has that moment or a couple moments like that when you're, you know, you get a bottle of wine and you bring it home and you open it up and you're like, wow, this is officially something that, unlike anything I've had before, is it's not just stimulating you in a physical way. It's not just getting you drunk or making you feel good, but it's stimulating you in an intellectual way. And that's when it's really exciting. It's like when it's both yummy and sort of engaging at the same time.
Absolutely.
So we're going to take a break. Thank you so much, guys. And you're going to hang out in the studio. And I'll definitely be asking you about some Thanksgiving wine. Like one white, one red, one white, one red. Okay?
Great.
When we come back, hopefully, with Mary Gay Tulloch.
Here in the morning after.
More Huntronic. This one's called Delivery Man on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
We are back here on The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. We have a very special guest on the line today with us. She is one of my favorite cooks, one of my favorite people to drink wine with, and she happens to be my mother. Mom, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great down here. Good to hear your voice.
It's good to hear your voice, too. I'm going to see you in a couple days. And we've got two lovely gentlemen on the show with us today, Mom. We were talking about wine, and I was talking about you, actually, and talking about how I'm very proud of you because you've been learning a lot about wine, and you're always up to taste new stuff. And has there been anything in particular lately that you've been enjoying, any particular wine?
Well, I go I enjoy the whites the most, I find. I go back and forth from Pinot Grigio to Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. I have learned recently about the Pinot Noir grape in the red wines.
Awesome.
It's more difficult to work with because the skin is very delicate, and there's a lot more involved for the winemaker to have a good batch of it. So,
you're killing it.
Yeah,
you're killing it. You're doing a great job. You're amazing. Now, I've called you, A, because I missed you, and also because I wanted to talk to you about, we were talking quickly about Thanksgiving and wine and food, and I wanted to ask you what you were planning on cooking this year.
Yeah. I've always loved to talk about that. We're going to be going traditional, which you already know all these foods. So, going to do turkey breast. That's uh-huh. easier. Everybody enjoys the white meat anyway, and it's just easier to go with that instead of the whole big turkey. I've right. tried that a couple times. I wasn't really successful with the whole turkey,
oh,
so
please.
I stick with what I know. And then we go with the corn pudding that everyone enjoys.
Oh, yeah.
Always try to do my best on making good mashed potatoes, which that's always iffy, it seems, no matter if they use the same ingredients every time, that sometimes they don't turn out the same. So hopefully we'll have a good batch of mashed potatoes and gravy.
Positive.
I learned how to make gravy from Gigi, your great-grandma,
uh-huh.
my grandma. Actually, she's the best gravy maker, and I still follow what she taught me years ago on how to make a good gravy for taste and consistency. And let's see, we'll have peas because I enjoy them with that meal.
Will Dad be having any of those peas?
Huh?
Will Dad be having any of those peas? I know how he feels about green vegetables.
Absolutely not. Every Thanksgiving, when we bring out the peas, he just asks that they be put at the other side of the table, so not only doesn't have to eat them, he doesn't have to smell them with the other things.
You're a very patient woman. Well, are you planning on having any wine with this delicious meal?
Always.
Oh, that's what we like to hear. Well, I love you, and thank you for talking to us quickly. We just wanted to hear your darling voice, and I'll see you in a couple days.
Okay, darling. Can't wait. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for talking to us. See you soon.
Have you too. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so Bo, Dan, what would you pair with Mary Gay Tulloch's Thanksgiving dinner?
So, I mean, sorry, where are you from again?
Well, I'm from Kentucky. My parents live in Tennessee now.
Live in Tennessee.
She's from Arkansas. Just the South.
Okay,
in general.
But in the South.
Just the
right.
South.
That's right.
Yeah. Right.
Got, yeah, that came. Yeah. you know, because it's the when you're making, it's different. It's hard making recommendations on wines for Thanksgiving in like this sort of broad national sense, because
right.
you can't pick one wine and say this is the one wine, because who knows if they can get that wine there. But so my recommendation is always drink what you like. That's the first. I think that's the most important thing. Like, why try and get a special wine for Thanksgiving that you're not sure about? I think drink what you like, and then beyond that, I would go with what you like and something that is refreshing. That's, you know, I don't go along with the idea that you need like a big heavy wine for big heavy food. I think you need a light refreshing wine for big heavy food, because you want to drink a lot of it and you want it to sort of, you know, kind of revive your palate and make you go back for another plate of corn pudding or
yeah, I want to know
or
about
peas.
That corn pudding,
I like peas. It's too bad your dad doesn't like peas, but my dad's kind of the same way.
My
actually,
dad will drink a glass of buttermilk and dip cornbread in it.
That's
right.
Amazing.
This is the kind of,
that's so great.
He's a Southern man.
That's so great. With that, you might need just some bourbon, though. Actually,
yep.
But no. So I would say, I mean, like, you know, I think Pinot Noir, which your mom mentioned. I think Pinot Noir and Gamay make wines for red wines that are refreshing and light and versatile. As long as you don't want something that's like oaky, you're gonna be fine that way. And for whites, I would say if you can get a good Chenin Blanc, mm-hmm. I think a Chenin Blanc either completely dry or even with a hint of residual sugar with a touch of sweetness. Either way, is a really nice wine to drink throughout a meal. So
it's gonna have some awesome acid.
Awesome acid and minerality, and like, you know, you may not be able to get, you know, Vouvray or Sauvignon or something, you know, in Tennessee. I'm not sure, but maybe you can get a South African Chenin Blanc, or, you know, here there's Chenin Blanc from Long Island that's even pretty good. So you could, you know, but that would be my recommendations.
Dan,
Well, I think that, you know, I'm with Beau that I think that you need something that's refreshing for Thanksgiving. But I think it's important to remember that sparkling wines are really, really good all the time. But particularly when you're going to have like a, you know, a bunch of food and a bunch of flavors, because again, it's a pairing based on acidity. But the bubbles are really, really refreshing. So, you know, either kind of get an excellent bottle of champagne. Nothing, you know, if you have your whole family there and there's a ton of mouths to feed, maybe something more like a good bottle of Cava, Crémant de Bourgogne or something like that. But you know, for me, you know, something with freshness and acidity and a little bit of bubbles is like, it's good for the
you're
whole.
You're drinking Dom P with your entire Thanksgiving.
Yes, I'm going to drink Dom Perignon.
I'm rolling up with some Cristal.
There you go.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to pass these recommendations along to the matriarch.
And I hope you can find all of them in Tennessee.
Actually, I have to say, they live in Nashville, which is...
I mean, it's probably it's an awesome wine store in Nashville.
There is, and actually, near my parents. Yeah. The last time we were home, we went and picked out a couple of bottles. My mom picked them out, actually, and they were fabulous. They had some wines I know and sell here in New York and I'm a big fan of, so I was happy to know they were close to good wine. Well, you guys are amazing. Thank you for laying the knowledge on us.
Thanks so much for having us. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, and everyone out there, have a happy, safe Thanksgiving.
Be safe. Don't drink and drive. If you must watch football, please don't get violent. Dad, I'm looking at you.
The Morning After, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.